We're set for an epic Final Four this weekend after a record-breaking Elite Eight. Plus, Thrill One is looking to turn skateboarding into a marquee sport across the globe. It's Thursday, April 4th. I'm David Rumsey in for Owen Poindexter, and this is Front Office Sports Today. As we head into the Final Four, it's time for our final Business of the Madness segment.
Business of the Madness is brought to you by Acura, which is now introducing the all-electric ZDX, crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars. The ZDX is Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy at Acura.com.
Caitlin Clark in Iowa women's basketball is set to face off against Paige Beckers and UConn in the Final Four after Iowa's record-setting game against LSU in the Elite Eight. Here to break down what this clash of titans means for college basketball, its ratings, and the future of its broadcasts is FOS senior writer and Tuned In columnist Mike McCarthy. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for joining us. March Madness has been full of records for viewership on the women's front. Tell us what all this means.
Iowa LSU drew a staggering number on Monday night. 12.3 million viewers, David, making it the most watched women's college basketball game of all time. What was even more special about it is this was an Elite Eight game, a regional final, and it blew away the 9.9 million championship figure from last year. So it just shows you, you know, the Caitlin Clark effect is real, that this surge in popularity around women's basketball is real. And here's another little news tip for you. This was the second most watched women's basketball game of any kind. I did some research last night and today, and I found that the only game that ever topped it was NBC's telecast of the gold medal game between Team USA and Brazil at the 1996 Atlanta Olympics. So it's a staggering number.
Wow, so we're talking all basketball, pro, college, Olympics, everything. That was the only one that topped it.
Everything. It's the biggest game in 30 years.
That is awesome. Let's start looking ahead to these Final Four matchups in the national championship game. Final Four starts on Friday night. Do you have any early predictions?
David, I think Iowa could set another record Friday night, but the game I'm really wanting, the dream matchup, is Iowa versus undefeated South Carolina. If those teams make it to the finals, I think that game could pull 15, 16 million viewers and draw even more viewers than the men's national championship.
Right, and we don't know what that matchup will be, but we do know it will be on cable, and the women's game will be on ABC, which I want to get into a little bit. Obviously, that's going to be better viewership on ABC with that network distribution, but this game is at 3 p.m. It's not in prime time. Can you talk to me a little bit about how it's ended up in that time slot on that day?
Yeah, this is going to seem a little counterintuitive, but I kind of dig that time slot. It's a great time slot because, Fox has shown, particularly with the noon window, that these daytime games can really soar. And I'm worried more about Friday's game because even though ESPN listed at 9 o'clock, you know it's not going to tip off till 9:30, which means a lot of the little kids who want to stay up to watch Caitlin Clark aren't going to be able to do it. So I really like the 3 p.m. time slot for the championship.
Right. And I think there's some sort of contract with Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN, and that's why the game can't go on ESPN, and it's on ABC, and there's primetime obligations. Do you think women's sports, women's basketball is getting to a point where maybe the powers that be at Disney would just move it to its best spot no matter what, or are they still fighting all these other components in sports and entertainment?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think the powers that be at Disney have seen the power of this sport, and that's why it's going to ABC. And it's a very Disney move, David. If you remember back 10 years ago, ESPN and Disney were very separate. But ever since Jimmy Pitaro took over, he's sort of merging them together. So a lot of the biggest events that used to be solely on ESPN are now simulcast on ABC. I'm talking about Monday Night Football, and especially ESPN's first two Super Bowls after the 26 and 30 seasons.
Mike, What are you hearing when you're talking to folks about these viewership numbers? We've talked so much about, will they break this record from the 9.9 million last year? And now it's done. And it was big, but now it just seems like, oh, this is happening. What is everybody telling you?
Well, I mean, not everybody is completely sold, David. You know, of course, we're all happy about the surge in popularity for women's sports, particularly women's hoops. But the big question is Caitlin Clark a unicorn? Are those numbers going to disappear next year for women's college basketball when she's played in the NBA? We saw it happen with Michael Jordan. You know, the NBA has never recovered its TV audience after Michael Jordan left. And you have these incandescent stars who not only move the needle, they are the needle. And Caitlin Clark has become one of them, like Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan.
Yeah, absolutely. After this game comes and goes, where do you think we'll be when we're heading into the next season for women's basketball and we're getting to next year's Final Four, which will be the start of a new deal for ESPN?
I think it's going to be just pure excitement. I think her going to the NBA is going to give the entire league a boost. And I'll tell you something, you know, they couldn't have better timing. Right now, the WNBA is looking for a new media rights deal. Their current media rights deal is comically low compared to other leagues. It's ridiculously low. So they're looking to make a big hit in their next right deal, and Caitlin Clark is the perfect way to do it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Spinning, of course, she's not even in the pros yet, but probably already starting to think about that. Indiana Fever are probably happy to have her too as well. Micah, this has been awesome as always. What are you up to this weekend? I hear you have something cool going on.
Yeah, I'm going to be speaking at Andrew Brandt's Sports Law Symposium at Villanova University. We're going to really examine the future of sports and sports media. Andrew is a great former executive for Green Bay Packers, turned consultant, turned law professor, and he's really an expert. So I'm really looking forward to sitting down with him and this audience of young students at Villanova and really getting deep into this.
All right, Mike McCarthy headed back to school. Thanks for joining us today and hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, David.
Even though Owen is out this week, you can still send him screenshots of your reviews for this show on Apple Podcasts at owen@frontofficesports.com for a chance to win a free Front Office Sports hat. Like I said earlier this week, who doesn't love a free hat? Up next, skateboarding will be back at the Olympics in Paris this summer. But can the sport maintain its renegade spirit while the biggest stars are collaborating with global brands? Thrill One CEO Matt Cohn spoke with Owen Poindexter to discuss the future of skateboarding.
I'm joined now by Matt Cohn, CEO of Thrill One Sports and Entertainment. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Owen, for having me. Great to be here.
Great to have you. So Thrill One, among other things, is the parent company of Street League Skateboarding. Start really high level here because I'm guessing some of our listeners know little to nothing about competitive skateboarding. So if you go to an event, what can you expect to see?
Street League Skateboarding is the premier Street League skateboarding competition in the world. It was founded by Rob Dyrdek. It's a competition that features the greatest skateboarders globally, men and women, young and old. In fact, two of our biggest superstars right now are 16 and 14. So it's a great competition. It's a global sport. And this weekend, we have the first of our new Apex events at the UFC Apex in Las Vegas, which will be the first ever spot-based, trick-based skateboard competition. We like to think it's Fight Club meets skateboarding.
All right. Wait, what's the Fight Club part of this?
There's going to be music playing. There's going to be nonstop action. It's going to be much faster paced, trick based, and more money and more prize money for our athletes. And it's just something that with the Olympics upcoming, we wanted to make it more of an experience for our athletes, more opportunities for our athletes to compete. And that's why we doubled the number of events this year.
All right. Gotcha. And so I caught some of the skateboarding, you know, competition at the Tokyo Olympics. It's largely trick-based, is that right?
It's trick-based with runs as well. So each athlete has the opportunity to compete as part of a trick, and they get judged based on that, but they also do long runs throughout the course as well from one end of the arena to the other.
And yeah, what did it mean for the competitive skateboarding world to be included in the Olympics? I mean, skateboarding is such a countercultural history. The Olympics is anything but countercultural. So yeah, what was it like to have those forces come together?
You're right. It's all about the culture. And if you do anything to upset the culture, it does not end well. Obviously, everything needs to be supporting the skateboarders and the athletes. And, you know, the Olympics, it's iconic. I think this is great for the sport, our league, and especially our athletes, many of whom will be participating and hopefully coming home with some medals.
Mm-hmm. And could you feel effects in the skateboarding community from having the Olympics include skateboarding last time around?
Absolutely. I think it really shines a light on our sport and our athletes and has led to a lot of the recent growth we've seen, especially given that the sport is so global. I mentioned two of the superstars we have. Raíssa Leal is a 16-year-old teenager from Brazil. Chloe Cavell is a 14-year-old superstar from Australia. And obviously the Olympics being the global competition that it is, having the sport lend itself so well where each country has its own skateboarders and its own competitors going, and each country takes pride in them. So I think while you mentioned the culture and how important it is to tap in, given the global nature of the sport and what it has always been, I think it's lent itself well and been accepted by the Olympic community.
And does that global nature of it, is that in some ways a challenge just in that it's maybe harder to have a central hub where kind of people know that this is where skateboarding culture kind of emanates from, or am I making too much of this?
It's not a bad point, but I think each kind of culture within its own has its own subculture, and it's something that we're trying to do with these superstar athletes I mentioned, going to their locales, going to their countries, having events in Sao Paulo, Brazil, having events in Sydney, Australia. Our next event after this one is in San Diego, California. So I think in the spirit of supporting our athletes and following them where they're from, it's never going to be one home base. It's going to be always somewhat of a traveling show. And I think that's the beauty of the sport.
And to what degree can people, you know, make a living as a skateboarder these days?
So that's part of the reason we decided to double our events. This year, we're going to have the largest prize purse ever in skateboarding. There's going to be $1.8 million total across men and women equally. Each of our events include prize money and points towards our Super Crown World Championship that takes place in December. So for us and our athletes, more events is more opportunities for them, more opportunities for their sponsors and the brand partners we have to engage, and then ultimately more money for them to be rewarded with for their athletics.
And yeah, you mentioned the pay equality across genders. What went into that decision to equalize things there?
It's been very important for us. You know, think similar to the UFC and where the athletes, there is no barrier to entry. There is no gender discrimination, color, creed. Anyone with a skateboard and four wheels can get on. And I think for us, being able to highlight that and the excitement we have for our athletes and the men and women equally being able to compete under the same rules, the same promotion, the same prize purse, really practicing what we preach is important to us.
How important are our sponsors and, you know, brand partnerships to these athletes in terms of, you know, again, making a living off of what they do?
Very important. The brand partners, they love to tap into this culture, and it's not easy for them to do so, whether it's us or our athletes or, and sometimes both. We provide that pathway. Today, we announced a new partnership with Samsung that will be a content series titled Road to Paris, leading into the Olympic Games. Raíssa Leal, an athlete of ours, is an ambassador of Samsung. And the point of these series is to really tap into that skateboarding subculture. And a blue chip company like Samsung wanted to tap into that younger, harder to reach demo. You know, this is not the fan base that's watching baseball or any stick and ball sports. They are unique. They are kind of counterculture, as you called it earlier, and being able to tap in an authentic way is extremely powerful for the right partners.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense that, those younger demographics, you know, the brands want to establish connections to them right now and finding a way in through a subculture that they're already invested in. It makes a lot of sense there. And I have to imagine that social media is kind of the link between these athletes and their fans, you know, more than anything else.
Absolutely. And creating content is part of their profession. Their brands support it. Being on the streets, and you know, we like to say we bring the streets to the league, but they have to also stay on the streets creating content, whether it's Nike, they're huge in skateboarding. Raisa Leal just released her Nike SB Dunk last week. It sold out in 15 minutes. She's been creating content in Brazil. She just did a great series in Los Angeles showcasing the sneaker that she designed. But it's very important for them to be in the streets creating content. You know, for us, allowing them to take the content from our events, share it on their social, allow them to have their own megaphone as well. It's all about reaching the masses as much as we can and providing the athletes the same opportunity to do so.
And are you seeing evolutions in how the sport is organized and conducted itself, you know, like different ways of competing or anything else that you see skateboarding moving toward to grow as it becomes, you know, more mainstream?
Yeah, even for us, you know, it is a challenge trying to grow the sport in the right way, in the authentic way. You know, having more events and more prize money is great, but we also need to do it in a way that the athletes would support, the fan base would support. Even doing the events at the UFC Apex, how would we make them unique and authentic to that culture? And the way we did it for this upcoming weekend is the spot-based format is created to replicate the Beverly Hills High School staircase, which is an iconic street skateboarding locale. So even for us, it's not just about more money and more events. We need to do it the right way. And it's definitely a delicate balance that we feel, and I'm sure all of our brand partners as well.
Yeah. And are you bumping into that tension of, yeah, you mentioned Samsung is, you know, a very sort of mainstream brand, whereas, yeah, skateboarding has kind of had its own culture, certain brands that you associate with skateboarding and that kind of grow together. Does that become an issue within skateboarding culture itself as, again, skateboarding looks to grow and tap into those bigger sources of funds?
We can't allow it to, and I think it's part of our job in professionalizing the sport and providing the opportunities. For example, if Monster, who is a big partner of ours, they're featured on our course and they're in our promotion, but some of our athletes might be sponsored by Red Bull, and it's no different than the NFL with their Nike uniforms, but Patrick Mahomes might wear Adidas. So I think it's just the nature of sport today, and it's important for us to kind of help guide the sport and our athletes toward the mainstream, and while not losing our touch and our taste to that subculture, but the brand dollars support us, support our athletes, and we can double down our number of events thanks to them. So I think it's important for us to continue to lead the way in allowing something that maybe 20 years ago, a sponsor's logo on the course might have been rejected, but now we have to make it unique and authentic how they're engaging, but we still want that Monster logo on our course.
Mm-hmm. And you were in the Olympics for the first time, you know, for the Tokyo Games. That was kind of a novelty. What is it going to look like when this is not a novelty? What does sort of establishment in the skateboarding world look like?
I definitely think it's easier the second time around, especially when it's not COVID. So yeah. I'm definitely excited. I think it kind of feels like the first time around. It's almost like we kind of tried it out in Tokyo and now really in Paris, which is also, you know, another great home of skateboarding. Our first event this season was held in Paris. I think the audience will embrace it and engage it. The skateboarder community in particular will, but I would not be surprised if some of our athletes become the face of the games and their personalities will definitely shine bright towards the broader community. And I'm very excited about that. I think they will benefit. I think the skateboard community as a whole and Street League skateboarding as well.
Yeah. And any adjustments to the Olympic Games or to the sport generally, I guess, that you see coming off of those Tokyo Games?
I think it's going to be more. You know, this year we did 8 events. We also want to be respectful of the games and our athletes competing. We will not have any events in June and July this year. We want to make it easy for them to travel and prepare and compete and hopefully win. But I think for us, our challenge is going to be how do we keep growing the number of events each year, 10, 12, 14, 16, while also allowing the Olympic Games to come the way that, whether it's the NBA or the NHL, all sports have had to deal with it, and it's no different for us. As we continue to grow, the Olympics Games will only support our growth, and it won't get in the way. We cannot allow it to.
All right. Matt Cohn, enjoy the chat. Thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me, Owen. Take care.
That's all for today. Thanks again to Matt Cohn for coming on the show, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please leave us a rating and review on the podcast platform of your choice. We'll see you tomorrow.